Welcome back to Alaska Voices. In today's episode, we will focus on the theme of next steps, new surroundings, new beginnings.
As we in Alaska seem to have come to a tipping point environmentally, socially, culturally, and economically, we spoke to many people also facing major change in their own lives. Some reflected on big choices they've made in the past, while others are using their own experiences to make the transition easier for new generations.
Our first conversation today is between Jesse and Abraham. Abraham came to us from Ethiopia and was our first graduate student that we advised. This conversation took place soon after Abraham had graduated from UAF in the Atmospheric Sciences Department. This conversation is titled, Donning a Flag for Graduation, that Teresa Bakker recorded and StoryCorps produced.
My name is Jesse Robertson. I'm 39 years old, and I am having a conversation today with Abraham, and I'm his PhD co-advisor, and you're also my colleague.
Hi, I'm Abraham Ndalamo. I'm 34 years old, and I'm having a conversation with my PhD co-advisor, Jesse.
Can you tell me about where you're from?
I'm originally from the northern part of Ethiopia, where there are so many environmental challenges.
What sort of challenges are they?
When I was very little, there were drought. So many people died because of famine, which is related to the drought.
You arrived in the fall, right?
Yeah.
And then, of course, we head into winter, which can be challenging for even people that have lived here forever. I remember you told me a story about heading to a final, right?
Yeah. I had an exam in December. That exam was scheduled on Saturday. So there was no campus shuttle.
No shuttle.
Yeah. I had no car, and the temperature was minus 55 centigrade at that time, and it was really, really cold for me. So I had to walk from my apartment. I was not really feeling part of my body, just kind of dead. And I had to run very fast. So I managed that exam.
One of the things I'm also interested in when people move to such a different place is the food. For example, what you would never eat in Ethiopia and have tried here, like hot dogs, for example.
Yeah. I never heard of hot dogs before I came here. So just the name dog, and no, I'm not eating that.
How long was it before you read the ingredients and knew that it didn't have dogs in it?
I was told even just right away, but just...
Just the word, you couldn't get past the name.
Yeah, I cannot.
The 2 months before you defended your PhD, we spent a lot of time together working on science and other things. And I'm curious, what was that experience like for you?
That 2 months are really very amazing for me. And I got to know you very much. And because of your help, the encouragement, I was able to push. And now I'm super happy.
You had a very quiet voice, and it was hard to hear you, especially in these rooms that were really, really loud. And so do you remember what we did? We had you read the newspaper right across the room to me.
Yeah, that was fun. It's partly cultural. We are not encouraged to speak louder. I prefer just to speak really quiet and even not that much often. But I also want to be heard. So I tried to speak louder after that. And I went home that day and I asked my wife for lunch, and I was really loud, and she was... Where do you get all this energy? And
why are you shouting at me?
Why are you shouting at me? No, it's not shouting, just it's talking.
Do you remember graduation day?
Yeah, I mean, that was really an amazing feeling. I had my flags on, my Ethiopian flag.
Yeah, I understand why you wore your country flag, but I didn't necessarily understand the significance of that to you, that you're able to express yourself here in this very authentic way that you might not be able to do at home.
Yeah. I really love my country, and there are not good things happening. Now it's just getting worse. Before I came here, I was kind of working as activist, organizing people to speak out, and there are challenges when you do that. And if I were in Ethiopia right now, I would be in jail probably, or probably I would be killed. So that time when I have my country flag on, I'm safe here, just I can put that on, just I can speak and represent my country, I mean, for a good. But I cannot be as happy as I want to be that day, because I really like to see my country free.
I remember you spent a lot of time talking and working with Abraham towards the end of his program. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Working with Abraham, he was just so gracious. And, you know, I'd give him feedback in my way that I try to give it politely. And I mentioned to him one time, I said, you know, well, you take feedback really, really well. And he said, well, why wouldn't I? He said, he's like, you know, you're just trying to help me become a better scientist. And of course, I want to hear that. We talked about just teaching, you know, like big lecture halls, and they don't always have a microphone. So then we drifted to the topic of his quiet voice. And I asked him, I asked if that was something he wanted to work on, since one of his goals was to become a teacher. And he said, yeah. And so we had a good time doing it. We grabbed some UAF newspaper or something, and we stood up in the top floor of IARC where it's really, really loud. I started standing like 6 feet away, and he read the paper, and then I stood farther and farther away. And it sounded like it ended up making a difference. So when he gave his final presentation for his thesis, my understanding of it and how he felt about it is he felt really good about it and he felt heard. But I'm curious, what were your thoughts on the conversation?
I was always interested and tried very hard to separate work and personal life with him. And so when we talked about how things were going at the university. Were there any things that were obstacles or things that he needed help with his job at the university as a scientist? And I never had any idea about his background or where he came from or that he was an activist or, you know, his statement about if he was still in Ethiopia, he'd either be dead or in jail by now. You know, those kind of shook me when I heard that the first time. And every time I hear it now, it still is like, dang, man. I'm not sure if I would have done it any differently, but it definitely opened my eyes and still kind of shakes me when I hear that.
So this next conversation is between colleagues Aaron and Gabe. Gabe is the manager of the Climate and Cryosphere Hazards Program at the Alaska Department of Geology and Geophysical Surveys. And Aaron is a professor of environmental science at the University of Alaska Southeast. Both Aaron and Gabe are scientists with the Alaska Climate Adaptation Science Center. This conversation is titled Welcoming a Newborn Just Before an Avalanche Cuts Power, which I recorded and Kelsey Skonberg produced.
My name is Aaron Hood. I'm 49 years old, and I'm talking with Gabe Wolken, who is a collaborator of mine on a number of different research projects.
My name is Gabriel Wolken. I'm age 45, and I'm speaking with Aaron Hood, who is a collaborator of mine. So, Aaron, welcome to University of Alaska Fairbanks.
Thank you. I was shocked to find when I got in this afternoon that it was warmer here in Fairbanks than it was in Juneau this morning when I took off.
Yeah, that's not uncommon, it seems. This year we've had at least 4 rain on snow events. This is the new normal.
Yeah.
We ski in January now.
You know, we can relate down in Juneau that our ski area opening was this weekend. It was the first time the area was open, and we've had the same thing, just a lot of rain on snow this year, and every time we built up a snowpack, it started dumping rain and resetting the whole ski area back down to the bushes again. So it's taken a long time to get it open.
But the avalanche danger is reduced as well, which is a good thing.
Yeah, that's the silver lining, I guess. There's a few things. When we get low snow years, the deer do very well. So people that hunt really like that. The skiing is not good. It's definitely not good for the glaciers, and then it is good for the avalanche danger. And as you know, we have probably the highest urban avalanche danger of anywhere in the United States. I'm actually teaching a snow hydrology, an upper division undergraduate level class in snow hydrology. And the students, we have all these outdoor labs where we're supposed to be digging snow pits and looking at stratigraphy and doing avalanche tests. And I had to cancel the first lab because there was nowhere to go dig a snow pit unless we were going to, you know, hike all 15 people up to the top of a mountain, which is going to extend well beyond our lab period. So it's been a challenge just trying to get out and teach students about what's going on with the snowpack when it doesn't really exist.
Yeah, we really need to have a better understanding of the avalanche hazards in the Juneau area. Beyond that, there are the few roads that actually come in and out of Juneau, there are multiple avalanche hazards along those corridors, as well as threats to the power lines that provide electricity to the community. So what we're trying to do is get enough interest to do some up-to-date studies on some of the avalanche hazards in the area so that we can at least predict some of the potential release areas. It's kind of hard to get these things funded.
Yeah.
And part of that is because there's so much variability in snow amounts from year to year. And when the snow accumulation is high, people are interested in it. When there's a lot of avalanches, people are interested in it. And when there's not, there's little interest.
The interest dries up very rapidly.
Yeah. And I think it wasn't too long ago in Juneau in particular where some of these avalanches that came down took out some of the transmission lines and caused some huge issues for the communities, not to mention for the company that provides power for the area. And some of the city of Juneau land holdings are in direct avalanche paths. And so I think it's really something that we need to look at.
It's a huge issue. There are neighborhoods and areas in Juneau that are beneath these avalanche paths. So it's not just an infrastructure issue. It's also very much a life and property issue. The hydroelectric facility, Snettisham, is down south of town. And so the power lines run right along the Stevens Passage, so kind of along the edge of this fjord. And there's all these steep chutes coming down. And it would have been April 2008. They got those big sort of end of winter, spring releases and just destroyed several of the towers. The electricity was completely cut off. The city went entirely to diesel generators. We were on our own grid. We're not interconnected to any larger grid. And it was actually a very interesting experiment because the price of electricity went up 500% in one day.
Wow.
And so we went from 11 cents a kilowatt hour to 55 cents a kilowatt hour. It was really nice, I thought, because every place was pretty dimly lit. And as a community, we cut our power usage by about 50% over the course of a couple weeks where they're repairing these power lines. And really, I don't think anyone would say that they were particularly inconvenienced. The reason I remember the date so well was actually that our middle daughter was born right before the avalanche, probably 2 days before. And we did the birth at home, and so we had a tub, and I had to heat this tub, and I had to heat the house up, so everything was just right. And then the avalanche happened, and the price of electricity went up, and they said, well, we're just going to charge your whole power bill the new price. And I said, wait a second. So I called them and I said, you can't do that because I use the most electricity that I've ever used in my life over the last 2 days. And a bunch of other people complained. So you can't backdate the power. We got that done before the avalanche. And so they agreed, okay, we won't start it until afterward. And then they fixed it. They switched the hydroelectric back on. The price dropped back down. And the electricity use went right up, pretty similar to where it was.
Thanks very much for the conversation, Aaron. It's great to chat with you.
Thanks. It was great talking to you about this. And I look forward to hopefully working with you on some of these things in Juneau in the near future.
One of the things that I was thinking about when I was listening to the conversation was how we're in this COVID-19 life now where you're largely restricted from travel and we are sort of adjusting to that new reality. I was wondering, you know, what our reality will look like when we come out of the COVID. Are we going to go back to the same lifestyle of all the travel and interactions, or what's it going to look like? When they were talking about, you know, the power getting cut down because of the avalanche, you know, nobody really seemed to miss it. But when the power came back, then everything went back to normal. And so
maybe as a society or as individuals, we fit into the size of box we're given, you know. And so when they're talking about the size of their electricity box shrunk and they all had to fit inside that, and they did, and then the box got bigger and then they expanded into that, and sort of similar with, I'm guessing, with the travel restrictions, once that's lifted, we're all going to hopefully be safer, but also expand into the box we're given. What came up for me when they were talking is thinking about rain in the winter I don't know if you remember that winter. It was like Thanksgiving a few years ago, and it was rain on snow, and it like shut the town down. I mean, buses were off the road, cars off the road, and couldn't even stand up.
The thing I remember from that is going to the grocery store and how all the shelves were cleared within a day or two because the trucks weren't able to actually get here. And it made me think a lot about, you know, food security and are we really prepared for a changing climate and how do we, I'm not sure we can prepare for that. It's definitely something to consider and think about and at least try to plan for as we go forward. Our next conversation is between Terry and Scott. Scott is the University Director of the Alaska Climate Adaptation Science Center and the Director of the Scenarios Network for Alaska and Arctic Planning. Terry is a retired Professor Emeritus of Ecology at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. This conversation is titled, Collaborating with Agencies, Communities, that I recorded and Kelsey Skomberg produced.
My name is Terry Chapin. I'm 73 years old, and I'm glad to be meeting with Scott Rupp, my friend and colleague for many years.
I'm Scott Rupp. I'm 50 years old, and I'm sitting here with my longtime mentor and colleague, Terry Chapin. Terry was a main driving force behind SNAP, the Scenarios Network for Alaska and Arctic Planning, when we sort of brought it up as a grassroots thing and were able to get buy-in from university leadership to provide some funding to move forward. Now in the more senior end of your career, you've really moved towards focusing on the societal importance of science and I think most interestingly, making those direct connections with communities and people. Is that something that just evolved and perhaps you're just following what was fun and exciting to do? Or did you also see perhaps that there was a need to push that way and you were at a point in your career where you could afford to put more energy into those aspects?
I was just starting college. I was concerned about social issues. I grew up in a segregated town and a segregated high school. And I got concerned about that stuff at one point and got involved in sit-ins and demonstrations and was arrested a couple of times. I had a social conscience at that point, but then my science always seemed completely separate from that. I never thought about applying a social conscience to the science I did. I sort of meandered through science doing what seemed interesting and novel at the time. And almost always what I learned was that the things I was doing in retrospect weren't very important. It became really clear that ecosystems are changing fast, and a lot of that has to do with human activities. And so unless I could begin to think about the integration of human activities and ecological processes, I wasn't really getting to the issues that are driving the exciting questions of science today. I guess I'm more and more impatient with the slow pace of science and feel like with the rate at which the world is changing these days, we really need to make progress.
It's a long game, right? And it does seem like we don't have the time to continue to follow that, but the institutional structures that are set up, at least for me, seems to be like one of the biggest challenges.
I'm just amazed at the way you've built up SNAP as a resource of science for non-science, for people who want information about how to make their decisions. What made you shift towards making science relevant to society?
The more that I was made aware of just how much people at the community level needed this information for various sorts of planning, whether it's personal or municipal or state or even national, it seemed like we needed to make a conscious effort to really focus on developing products and information.
You've been very good at reaching beyond the university and the things that you've done with USGS and other agencies have been the kind of thing that often the university doesn't do very well. How have you managed to make that work so effectively?
You know, so SNAP came online as the Bush presidency was ending and we were going into the Obama years. There was a switch in the government in terms of a cognizant focus on climate change and climate science being part of the decision-making process of the federal government. And so I don't know how unique it is to Alaska, but I just met really interesting, passionate people that were working at the ground level here in Alaska for these agencies. And it was really easy to start collaborating with them because they were fun people to work with and excited. And it felt like what we were doing had immediate and direct relevancy to decisions that were being made at the federal level. And that was pretty exciting. You know, now that's something that we've got these long-term relationships within agencies. And even though the people have begun to change, those relationships are still pretty solid.
I've never worked with agencies at the level that you have, and I admire you for being able to do that. But I've gotten really excited about working with some of the communities rather than thinking of the university as a group that would provide knowledge and through outreach to the communities, try to turn that around so it was the communities reaching in, just as you were saying earlier, for information they wanted. It was exactly analogous to what you said about SNAP.
A big part of science, or at least science that's fun and productive and relevant, is actually making sure you spend time and energy on developing personal relationships, whether it's with your colleagues or agencies or communities that you're interacting with. But it seems like in this fast-paced world we live in today that it's easy to dismiss the time and effort it takes to do that.
That's right. And it seems important to undertake those relationships with people that have similar goals and a similar willingness to let go and trust the other person to work with you on for the best interests of society and for the efforts that you're trying to do together jointly. And it's got to be fun.
Well, this was fun too. Thank you for having this discussion.
It's been fun, Scott. That's been the best part of this conversation, is just having a chance to talk about things that we haven't talked about for quite a while.
Before I moved to Alaska, I knew I wanted to try to learn the systems up here, do some research, and I was trying to develop a research project, but it's always tough to do when you come from a completely different system. And I didn't have any colleagues up in Fairbanks or anyone really. I did get to meet with Terry. I talked about my project idea, and I sort of felt like I was babbling away. And he sat and kind of stared at me. You know, when I finally finished talking, that's when he chimed in and was just so supportive and had really good ideas and good things to try. And I realized, like, oh, he was actually just listening to me, taking it all in and giving me some meaningful feedback. I guess he reminds me of Abraham, you know, who we heard from earlier today, as being this very gracious person who knows who he is. He's solid in who he is. And so he doesn't seem like there's any ego wrapped up when he helps people.
I think he's always trying to build people up and not tear people down.
That's exactly it, yeah.
And I think it's even more powerful just knowing he's a world-famous scientist who wins awards. And so if he can be, you know, this yes-and person and build people up, then I think that's a valuable lesson for all of us.
The next conversation is between Matt and Kathy, and they are colleagues at the Los Alamos National Laboratory, but have spent a lot of time in Alaska. Also, Matt received his PhD from UAF. Our next conversation is titled Expanding Scientific Literacy Beyond the Research Realm, that Bob recorded and Kelsey Skonberg produced.
Okay, I'm Kathy Wilson. I'm 62 years old. I'm with my friend, Matt Hevner.
And I'm Matt Hevner. I'm 46 years old. And we're friends and colleagues and co-workers, co-conspirators.
What really gets you going? What's your the most exciting part of what you're doing now?
What I've always enjoyed is teaching and communicating and trying to describe why I enjoy physics and math to people. But I pick things that are really fascinating, and then it's easy for me to talk about and communicate to other people why they should care, which I think that's the big challenge scientists face. But so I've done, yeah, a lot of flashy science, like with lightning. I've done some bat research that you know about. When I was a professor down in Juneau, we had this undergrad. He was the first generation in his family to go to college. He struggled really hard. He came in and had to do remedial math, but he sort of kept with it. And he graduated with a math degree in the end. I got him, you know, a little bit of funding from NOAA to do a question that he was interested in on the glacier. Mendenhall Glacier is literally just a hike from campus. So he got to do the field work, and he presented a poster at a conference. About a year and a half sort of intense work with him to teach him what science is, you know, how scientists think. And at the very end, he said, "Thank you. That was a fantastic experience. I understand now better what scientists do. It's not for me." And I was like, that's success. If the public who isn't a scientist knows what we do and why, then we've done good in education.
One of the things that I've really loved about working at Los Alamos National Lab is the opportunity to, and the kind of the need to be flexible in terms of how you apply your science and what kind of national, big national questions or issues come up. This is a progression I think most people go through in their lives, having some projects that they work on or a thesis that they work on that's typically pretty scientific, or of course you'd be working on it forever, and then engaging in your career where you have an opportunity to really start putting science in the context of the bigger picture and the impacts on humanity or the interactions with, you know, who we are as humans in society.
So I was then on the faculty at UAS for about 7 years, got tenure, got a permanent job, skipped that, went back to Los Alamos. I came back as a project lead for the nuclear detonation detection capabilities. But while I did that, you know, I was curious. I wanted to understand the societal relevance, and I made the mistake of starting to read policy documents. You know, what is the nation's capability, and how are we doing in detecting and monitoring and making sure there's no nuclear proliferation? And it was an interesting snapshot outside of the lab. Back in the 50s, we were really good at this. In the 60s and 70s, we got better, and then it's kind of lapsed. And so I started asking around the lab. I was like, if this overall capability is in a state of decay and that's what I'm working on, shouldn't we be more engaged in that national conversation? And oversimplified, people said, "You're talking funny. Go out to D.C. So then I went to OSTP, the Office of Science and Technology Policy, and really got involved in looking at how whole of government coordinates for that kind of issue, how investment decisions are made, even just how information is communicated up from somebody like my former self who knew the individual bits on a satellite, all the wonky details, how that got up to the White House for this event happened. Here's the key information you need to know. So it's a fantastic opportunity to really pull together basic science and national level policy discussions.
You know, I never would have considered myself a climate scientist, but now if I'm sitting on a chairlift at Taos ski area and somebody gets on the chairlift with me and says, "Hey, so what do you do, you know, for a living?" Typically now I'll say, "Oh, I'm a climate scientist." But that route was very circuitous because my training is math, then hydrology, geomorphology, and now climate science. And sometimes the response would be, "You don't believe in that crap, do you?"
Right.
And my first response would be something like, "I don't consider it a belief system. It is based on the same sort of science and technology that we use to understand how a lot of things work. Like we use computational fluid dynamics, which are the same type of science that's used to make sure your airplane stays in the air." One of the things that's really brought you and I together now as coworkers, there's the broader issues of national security and climate impacts on national security, but especially in terms of the Arctic. It's changing so rapidly, and it bridges everything from the climate science and how the operational environment is changing on land and in the Arctic Ocean, but also space weather, space conditions.
Communications. Tourists that are up there, search and rescue, the whole thing.
Yes, that's right.
And it even ties in, I mean, geomorphology of where are the resources, you know, who's going out to the...
Energy development, yeah. You know, right.
What do you think the biggest challenge is you face in your career right now?
I think our biggest challenge is that we're mincing words about a really big problem, that human impacts on the climate system are real and serious, and we're driving the Earth into new states that are unprecedented, and we're likely to lose the cryosphere.
In the national security, global security world, it's, well, other countries are going to be up there. The ice is thinner. You know, how are our boats going to work? How is, you know, we've got more people that are going to be tourists up there, and we have to do search and rescue. We don't care why they're going. They're just going. The biggest challenge, I think, is probably fundamentally education. But beyond that, understanding the role that science plays in policy discussions. Science should be the bridge across political groups. So I think that's the biggest challenge, you know, as a society we face.
Well, Matt, I really enjoyed having a chance to learn more about where you come from and what you're thinking about.
Thanks so much. It was fun talking.
Bob, you've known Matt and Kathy for a long time in various capacities as a friend and colleague. I'm curious what came up for you when you listened to that conversation.
The idea of redefining success and defining success, how it relates to society. They know the tiniest, most minute details about everything or about what they work on, and then they can blow that back up into the bigger picture of how it relates to society or a project. What about you? Did anything stand out for you?
They're both in Los Alamos, and so when I hear them talk, I'm from Los Alamos. I grew up there. So the lab was this like entity in town with fences around it and guard gates. They have this huge perspective, linking all these different fields and ideas and possibilities. But when you have a conversation with them about, you know, your science or a life topic or whatever, it's just a very friendly, wonderful conversation. All the people we've talked about today have this particular type of being or way of moving through the world that is so welcoming and inclusive of other people and makes it just really easy to talk about whatever, you know, to get to know them as people and scientists. Our next conversation is between Bob and Rachel, who are good friends. They discuss how they met and how Bob met his wife, Jessie, who is in no relation to me. And the Bob in this conversation is in no relation to the Bob on this project. The following conversation is titled An Average Field Season Other Than Meeting the Spouse and was recorded by Bob Bolton and produced by Kelsey Skonberg.
Hello, my name is Bob Busey. I'm 41 years old, and I'm going to be talking to Rachel Bolton, who is a good friend.
And I am Rachel Bolton. I'm 35 years old, and Bob is a very good friend of mine. So when I first moved to Fairbanks 6 years ago, I heard a story about how you and your wife, Jessie, became a couple.
Yeah.
So that's completely false, or it's like...
Probably like more interesting and less interesting. Basically, the way that it all went down was this office that we were talking in was my office when I first came to IARC, however long ago that was, 2006. And at that point, my former boss, Larry, was not the director of IARC or the vice chancellor that he is today. And I'm kind of his extended arm for like making sure all that, all these stations, weather stations in the middle of nowhere and climate stuff just keep running and collect good data and all that sort of stuff. And so sort of like in this educational role of the university, I would take random grad students or people out. Part of it was make sure they get exposed to new ideas. The stereotype is that if you're doing all the computer stuff, you're so locked into your numbers and your program and your computer that you're not like, even though you think about what nature is like, it's a little bit more abstract. So you're not involving all your senses when you're in the office as compared to out in the middle of nowhere. I have a good idea for how people lie to me about what their limits are, and I do a good job of guessing what their true limits are so that we don't go beyond them. And also we don't do anything silly, we don't get hurt. And within that framework, I still like to push people. And so, like, sort of their formal role in this is to make sure that I don't die. And my role is to make sure they experience a different part of the world that they wouldn't get to otherwise, and gives them some things to think about in their academic work. That was the setting in which Larry proposed that this new postdoc that was fresh on campus should join me. And that was Jessie. And she was fresh from New York City, being there for 10 years, doing all of her schooling and et cetera. And at that point, I had like a bunch of equipment on order that I was sure was not going to arrive. And so I was pretty much like, I'm sorry about this. This is going to be just a big hornswoggle of a trip. You know, you're like,
yeah,
we're going to be a lot of driving. It's not going to be that fun. Thank you for coming. And there was a lot of driving, but we did a lot of chatting on the driving. We were expecting a package that hadn't arrived yet. And so we would drive back to Nome to go to the airport to see if the package was here. Because it was, you know, 2006 technology wasn't quite what it is today.
Right.
Even though it's not that long ago. I bet we had sat phones, but like...
very bare bones, not smartphones. You didn't have a lot of stuff on them.
You would only use it for safe and emergency back then.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. So like something that's frivolous as, hey, has my cargo come in? That right. was like outside the scope of what somebody would pay for. We went our separate ways. There was this thing called food stock, I think, and I invited her to go to that. And I think we both were like independently like, I don't know. And so shortly after that, we were like went camping on 4th of July maybe. And I think by August, September, we were definitely like living together. And fast forward till today and we're like still.
We're still together.
Yeah. But no, on the trip, there was nothing.
That's nothing.
Whole, yeah. Totally. I think I bored her to death, or I was like, I'm a kind of a polarizing person, you know. From a stranger, I'm pretty obnoxious, I think. Or that's my impression.
You guys are such special friends to us because we had a private wedding ceremony.
Yeah.
And so you guys were literally the only people to witness us getting married besides the photographer and the
I was just looking at your pictures this a couple weeks ago. All of these years, I've been had a digital camera since like 2000-ish. So I've been like trying to organize. And that's why I came across your guys' pictures.
I was actually in my wedding dress for like 2 hours, I think, tops, because we went to the restaurant afterwards, and then mm-hmm. we all changed into our clothes, and we went camping.
Yeah. And we watched those people in the RV unload
That's
all
right.
Of their
those people next
stuff.
To us had this totally dope RV. It was, like, huge. It looked like something out of the Fast and the Furious. Like, the whole thing was huge and black with, like, tinted windows, but then they had that whole back compartment.
Yeah, where, a magical trapdoor.
Yeah, the magical trapdoor where the ATVs rolled out of.
But they kept coming and coming. It was like the rabbit trick where you're just like, hey, look at this. There's another rabbit. Hey, look at this. It's another rabbit.
Yeah. And they're immortalized too because we took that photo around the campfire and they're actually in the background. The RV and the couple
are both
in the background of like our wedding photo.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Well, I know I really appreciate your friendship because you are literally one of the first people I met of Bob's friends.
Pretty literally.
Because like,
he was like, hey, can I bring a friend to our Thanksgiving party?
And that was like my big debut.
Yeah.
My big Fairbanks debut meeting you guys, which is terrifying, walking into a room, you know, all of his people. So, no, I'm really glad that we met and that we've stayed friends and that we're able to do this afternoon. So, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
So, what did you get out of that? What did you enjoy about that conversation?
Let's see. I've known Bob, I guess, since the day I moved here, and Rachel, since you all have been together. I guess I sort of accidentally ended up at Bob and Jesse's wedding. This was very early. I think it was my first summer in Alaska. Jessie was great in terms of being supportive. And so she found some funding for me to go with her and Bob and one of Bob's childhood friends and one of Jessie's long-term friends and then a permafrost scientist. We all went to Nome, Alaska. And then on the flight, Jessie said, oh, by the way, Bob and I are getting married tomorrow. And it was just kind of neat how it all kind of rolled out where the permafrost scientist that was there, he officiated the wedding and he was nervous and practicing in his room what to say. And I thought, wow, I really don't know any of these people. And I ended up at this kind of cool wedding on a beach in Nome. And then we went and got pizza.
Rachel and I, we got married on a beach in Valdez, Old Town Valdez. And And it was warm and sunny in interior Alaska. And we drove over the top of Thompson Pass into like this big cloud bank, and it ended up not raining on us, and ended up having a really fun time as well. Rachel has always wanted to know what we do and when we go out in the field. And so we took her to Ukiavik, formerly Barrow, last summer. And Bob was so open and brought Rachel in and let her do some of the research and helped switch out some of the sensors. And she was part of the team. And Bob's always done that. The next conversation, and I guess our last conversation for the series, is between Jim and Eric, who are friends and colleagues. Jim works at the National Weather Service, which is where they met. Eric is currently at the Alaska Interagency Coordination Center, helping with wildfire prediction and response efforts. This conversation is titled, Stepping Off the Plane to Roaring Northern Fur Seals, which I recorded and was produced by Kelsey Skonberg.
My name is Jim Brader, age 53, and my relationship to the partner is a colleague and friend.
And I'm Eric Stevens, age 49. Relationship to partner, I wrote down nemesis, coworker, and friend. So, covered all the bases there. Well, Jimmy, you know, you told me a while ago about your job interview that you had when you were in Wisconsin and you wanted to get a job, any job, and there was this weather service opportunity in Alaska. And you had been told to stand by the phone. This is how I remember you telling the story anyway.
I had just finished college, and you know, I thought I'd have to be able to decode the RAOB data, which is the weather balloon, or the surface observations, which we had to do in school. And he said, oh, no, don't worry about all that. We'll teach you that stuff later. I just need to know if you can take care of yourself. I had some rice and beans, and I knew you could live on that if you had to, and I put that in my stuff that got mailed to St. Paul Island. I'd never been on an airplane, actually, till I went there.
Wow.
And St. Paul Island is really, it was like a Dorothy in Oz experience, because the plane landed, and they opened the door, and the first thing I noticed was, and that was the sound of the Beachmaster, the big bull seals.
Oh.
The first thing you heard was that, and then you caught the smell, and it smelled like a Wisconsin cow barn. And it's July 17th, and it's 53 degrees. And then when I was brought into the office, you know, the first thing I noticed was they were gathered around the TV watching Mr. Rogers. And that was my introduction to weather. And I was just thinking, I came from the University of Wisconsin where they developed Mechitis computers and actually precursor to what we use in the Weather Service now.
They invented satellite meteorology there.
And here I am at a place where they watch Mr. Rogers. So when I was at St. Paul Island, the sea ice came down. The first winter I was there, it was pretty neat seeing all the jagged chunks of sea ice and climbing up one of the hills and being able to look to the north and it's just white. At that time, the sea ice would get to St. Paul about once every 2 or 3 years. And now it rarely gets there at all.
Yeah.
When you do weather forecasting, every year is different. I mean, there's years with lots of snow and years with no snow, years where it's warm, years where it's not. And it's sometimes hard to see a trend because we're living in the moment of all the ups and downs.
Mm-hmm.
But the sea ice is something that is really dramatic. At that time, in the late 80s, there were years where they couldn't get a sea lift into Prudhoe Bay. Mm-hmm. They couldn't get the barges in with supplies and modules to build stuff. And so that was a big deal, you know, being able to get the barge in. And they would call us a lot about that. Seemed like once you got to the mid-90s, usually there was open water offshore for at least a couple months. They could get a barge up there. Somewhere around 2000, well, you didn't worry about it. There always was open water.
Just a question of how long will the open water season be?
Yeah. I think it was 1 or 2 years ago the ice melted at the North Pole. This year, There were waves at Barrow on December 21st.
Whoa, really?
There were waves crashing on the beach. Normally, Barrow's frozen up by, I think, the beginning of November.
Okay, here's where I take over. In the weather business, the weather and climate are different. And it eventually becomes climate, but it's not quite the same thing. You're caught in the immediacy of the particular scenario of the day, and subtle long-term trends may not be noticeable when you've got your nose so close to the page there. I just went around and around in my head trying to find occasions where some climate signal would actually mean something to the line forecaster at the Weather Service. And I finally found it at Barrow in October. Normal in October in Barrow used to assume you were iced in and so you could get cold. Well, now it's no longer icy in October, and so your temperatures now, if you want to use normal temperature statistics as guidance, you're out of luck. You can't get cold with open ocean. You got to put a lid on that
right, to
prevent the moisture and the heat from fluxing up off the surface into the lower atmosphere there.
And then we have to deal with how do we keep people safe? There's avalanches in mountainous areas that can bury people, and those are dangerous. But other than that, coastal flooding is our most dangerous thing. That's where it damages the most property and potential to injure people. And the sea ice was the buffer that kept that from happening.
Shields up, Scotty.
You know, this year we didn't have a shield, essentially. And last week I put out a coastal flood warning. I've certainly never put one out in January or February or March, and I did, and there was coastal flooding.
Wow.
I mean, it's always been an issue. You know, every 10 years, Nome has a big coastal flood, and Kotzebue, you get some flooding every 5 years and that kind of thing. But now the potential is it can happen much more frequently because instead of a two-month window, we've got a four-month or five-month window.
A true mark of professional expertise on an agency level will be if the National Weather Service can keep up with the changing underlying climate upon which daily weather is superimposed. If we can keep up with those broad-scale changes and not have to learn the hard way more often than necessary, that will be a real service to the public. And with that, I think we've probably summarized. I got the last word. This is your opportunity to say no, you didn't.
No, that's it.
Jim and Eric recorded their story around the time that Barrow's name returned to its traditional name, Utqiagvik. Bob, what did you think about this conversation?
They're both fantastic storytellers, but at the same time, they're able to communicate their knowledge in a way that's understandable and relatable to everyone. And I think that's a gift and a skill that I'm not sure if it comes naturally to them or if it's something they've developed over time, but I think it's a great, great conversation to end today's show on.
What I appreciate they talked about is how our cryosphere, and in this case, sea ice, acts as a buffer. And I've thought about this idea of something being a buffer or like a safety net. So one way I think about it is snow can kind of act as a moisture buffer because it's a lot of water that sits there for a long time and then is released into our ecosystems and streams. And then, you know, permafrost, part of the cryosphere, can act as a buffer in a way because the thawed soils that sit above it are usually pretty wet and leaves a lot of water available for, you know, biology to happen.
What do you think about the show in general?
Yeah, so one of our original goals of Alaska Voices when we started this several years ago is to bring the human component into conversations about science. And today was such a good example of that. All of our conversation partners are these wonderful, authentic people who are so easy to listen to and so easy to talk to, but they also know their craft really well. And because of who they are, they also share their craft really well with others. Science is so much more than just numbers and data. And that's part of what we knew going into this. It's also the people that are part of this. It's the relationships. It's the personalities. How about you? What comes up for you?
Thinking about like the goal of Alaska Voices and humanizing science, I think we've achieved that. But for this episode specifically, I think it's also pretty cool how the scientists brought their work and their crafts to humans, to society. being able to relate how their work fits into the bigger societal needs and societal goals. It's a skill and that we all should be working towards and working on, being able to communicate our work and being certain that people can understand what we're doing and why. Today marks the end of the run of the Alaska Voices radio show for this summer.
Thank you for spending some of your time with us, and we hope that you have enjoyed the project. If you want to listen to conversations you have heard this summer again, or hear more conversations from our collection, please visit our website. And we're releasing 2 podcasts per week until October, which can be downloaded from your favorite podcast platform or from our website.
If you would like more information or like to provide any feedback, please visit the About page on the Alaska Voices website. Before we end the show today, I just wanted to say thank you, Jesse, for doing the radio show with me this summer. It was a lot of fun to work and talk with you about the project and the conversations. I also want to thank Kelsey for all of her hard work and patience in working with us to make this something that we're both really proud of.
Thanks, Bob. I echo that. Thank you for the hard work and time that you've put in this summer. And it's been really fun to talk with you about these conversations and ponder this project from so many perspectives. It's also been very cool to see Alaska Voices come to life from a conversation in a restaurant in San Francisco several years ago to today, when we can share these conversations with others in our communities. And a big, big thank you to the Alaska Climate Adaptation Science Center for supporting this effort. This was awesome. Really, really fun. I'm glad we could do this. Alaska Voices builds bridges by creating a space where community members, friends, policymakers, and scientists can share stories and place-based knowledge. This project was developed in partnership with StoryCorps and was funded by the Alaska Climate Adaptation Science Center. Additional funding was provided by the University of Alaska Fairbanks Chancellor through a generous gift from the Bentley Family Trust to the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Alaska Voices would not be possible without the help and efforts of an amazing group of people. Our producer and audio engineer is Kelsey Skonberg of Mossy Stone Media. Our podcast and outreach specialist is Mike DeLue. And our website designer is Carolyn Rosner.
We would also like to thank the following musicians whose songs we heard today. Arctic Evening by Marcel Duprise, Grace Snow Instrumental, and Lafayette Instrumental by Josh Woodward. I'm Glad You're Here, A Bit Sentimental, and Listening by Mon Plaisir, Balance, Together We're Stronger, and Time by Kumiku, The Beauty of Maths, Freezing But Warm, and Story by Maiden, The Sifle Branches by Axletree, and A Brand New World by Kai Engel.
If you are interested in more conversations or information, please visit our website at alaskavoices.org. For Alaska Voices, I'm Jesse Robertson.
And I'm Bob Bolton.